This is American Fashion Podcast. I'm Charles Beckwith here with Kathy Sheppes.
Hey, everyone.
And our guest in the studio is Will Welch, the editor-in-chief of GQ Magazine and GQ Style.
Yes, sir. You got both in there. Thank you. Hey, guys.
Well, you've got both in there. How are you balancing those two?
That part has been really fun and pretty organic and natural. So I spent the last 3 years as the editor-in-chief of GQ Style, which started as a quarterly spinoff magazine from GQ. And then in 2018, I was creative director of GQ and editor-in-chief of GQ Style. And then when I started at the top of 2019 as editor of both, it really has just been all one team, seamlessly kind of working across GQ, GQ Style, GQ.com, social, video, all that stuff. And that allows us to have a lot of fun, like playing with the dials. I mean, the thing that made it possible is that GQ Style, over the 3 years that it's been in existence, we, I think, carved out a pretty clear editorial voice and path for it that is distinct from GQ. So even as over the last few months, we're 4 issues into this new era of GQ now, even as we've been playing with the dials of that, like, GQ Style still has its own idea behind it, which is a little bit farther down the rabbit hole, if you will, in terms of fashion, culture. It's like GQ is culture and GQ Style is deep culture.
Okay.
You guys aren't buying it. Something like that. Culture and subculture.
We have to pay more attention, I think.
Well, yeah. I'm wondering how you keep it separated in your head. This piece of content is going to this, or this piece of... Well, do you have things that... Like, you have a light version in the magazine, the normal magazine, and then GQ Style has, like, multiple pages, or...
No, we don't publish across the two, so okay. We really think of them each as a distinct magazine, and it's just sort of, like, for instance, say somebody brings up the name of a new independent designer that we want to cover. Like, the reality is, in GQ, that's probably going to get one page, and a lot more people are going to see it. The other option is to do it in GQ Style, and we could probably give it like 6, 8, 10, 12 pages, and less people will see it, but it's going to be this deep dive, and GQ Style is printed on this really thick, glorious paper. And so it's almost like, how visual of a story are we trying to tell, and how broad do we want this to go? Or, like, what is the capacity for, you know, is this for a broader audience, or is this like really for the heads, for the fashion heads? You know what I mean? Or yeah. It could be like, we just did a piece about Jason Dill, who is a professional skateboarder that has his own fashion brand and has had a really, he's an incredibly influential guy. He's also had a lot of personal ups and downs. But he's not like, he's certainly not famous. Even in the fashion world, he's really dealing with this, like, this skate streetwear side of things. And to people in that world, he's like a huge deal. He's one of those guys where you either know everything about him or you've never heard of him. And that's like, that's a GQ Style story. And it's like 14 pages or something.
Do you think we're getting to a point where streetwear is going to have a lot more terms under it that people will be able to identify, that's beyond skate and like...
Are we
developing new genres within that are going to be identifiable?
That is possible, but to me, it's kind of like we're headed in the other direction, which is also really exciting, which is that terms like streetwear. I mean, like, Prada does streetwear now, and so does an actual skate brand. And sometimes it wouldn't be what the one doing one thing wouldn't be what you would assume. And so in a way, like, those boxes and those terms are just getting increasingly irrelevant, and it starts to just feel like fashion.
Yeah.
And
but then how do you find it?
How do you find it?
Like, I want this kind of thing. How do you find that kind of thing if everything is everything?
Yeah. Well, that becomes the challenge of the curators, which includes magazine editors, that includes retailers, that is a challenge that the fashion brands themselves have to figure out how to navigate. Like, how do we get this something that we're trying to do in front of the right audience at a time where things are like, there's this, I find, very beautiful, like, ebb and flow, and even ideas of like, this is fashion, that's not fashion, he's not a designer, that's a real designer. Like, those things are getting increasingly absurd, which to me is like a great pleasure.
So I feel like streetwear is just, you know, I think kind of what you're saying, there's just a broader sense of it. So, yeah. I mean, Prada doing it is just, it's not doing what they normally do, which is so sophisticated and kind of playing it down to what everybody's looking for.
Or they're trying to bring the sophistication of Prada, like fabrication and design, to a piece or a style that is not what we have traditionally over the, you know, the last few decades associated with what they do. Like, when I think of Prada menswear from a broad sense, the first thing I think about is the three-button suit. They do them. They'll probably always do them, but that's not like what is out front over the past few years. And but the great thing about Mucha Prada is what's out front changes every season. So for me, that world, that aspect of the men's fashion world right now is just incredibly exciting. And it gives us the opportunity to have all kinds of different fun. You know, there's not a lot of boundaries and borders. And that to me is a good thing.
I mean, I think a Hugo Boss like that, like then also some companies are trying to move. Like Hugo mm-hmm. Boss on the runway looks kind of completely different than Hugo Boss when you go into the stores.
That's right. Yeah, they're putting a certain foot forward with their runway show. And you're right. There's a store. I work in the Condé Nast, which is the parent company of GQ, is in One World Trade Center. And the Oculus, the new Calatrava transit hub, is connected to our building. And so I walk from the C train across the Oculus, and the Oculus, in addition to being a beautiful, arguably beautiful piece of architecture and a transit hub for both the MTA and the New Jersey Transit, is also a mall and is full of retail, including Hugo Boss. And you're right. What I see on the runway when I go to the Hugo Boss show is different than what's in the window or when I walk into that store that is just below my office.
I think it's inarguably interesting, whether it's beautiful or not. It's something.
The Calatrava Transit Hub. Yeah. Yeah. I am very smitten with it from the inside, because he just created like really a hell of a civic space. He says hopefully, while also knowing that it's a mall.
Yeah.
It looks like the back of a what is that dinosaur? Stegosaurus?
Yeah.
From the outside, including from, you know, we're above it in One World Trade Center, so we have a view down on it. And I can't say that I love it from the outside.
It's but a being weird, in there weird thing is, from the outside. Yeah. Inside, it's this kind of white space that's got contours. And
yeah. This past weekend, my wife came by my office with me, and we were in the transit hub that connects to One World Trade Center. And she was like, "You work in the future." And it really does feel like that. I mean, it's like the inside of the Calatrava is like, it's very Star Wars. Yeah.
So perfect lead into Hudson Yards.
Yeah, Hudson Yards. I haven't spent a lot of time at Hudson Yards yet.
Oh,
have okay. you?
Yeah, I mean, I went to the opening and then went another time. So I feel as if it's not really the future.
Mm. Yeah.
It feels more like a mall. Have you gone?
I've only been over there as it was a construction site. I haven't been to the open, I guess what they're calling specifically Hudson Yards. I've been in that area quite a bit.
Right. Yeah. I feel like it was an opportunity for stores to put forward another step.
Yeah.
And they didn't. It's just like the same blueprints. Of,
right. Another store of X, Y, or Z.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same with Neiman's, which is too bad. Looks like it's beautiful. Looks like other Neiman's.
Right. Yeah. I haven't been yet. I want to go check it out, but hasn't happened so far.
So let's talk about GQ.
Sure,
so you're making GQ more modern.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's definitely the intention. It means a lot of things. I guess the biggest picture, like the first thing that I was really reiterating to the team over and over at the start of this new era, was this idea of, I really don't think now that this is the environment for general interest. So over the past 30 years, like GQ started going all the way back as a magazine called Apparel Arts, and then it was very much a men's fashion magazine. And then over the last 30 years or so, it really came to be a general interest magazine. Like anything could fit in into an issue of GQ. That was a great position of power for the brand for many years, but I think now in the digital era, focus is incredibly important. And if you're going to stand out, you can't try to be everything to everyone. You have to be really declarative. This is who we are. This is what we believe in. This is what we cover. This is what it's about. And so I felt like this was an important time to sort of just focus on the two things we do best, one of which is men's fashion style and lifestyle. And in some ways that sounds broad, but I think we have a pretty firm view of our point of view on that. And then also world-class long-form journalism with a bit of a gonzo edge that we're known for. So yes, there are other magazines, the New Yorker comes immediately to mind, that do incredible long-form journalism, but I think there's a GQ version of that that has emerged over the years that you can really only get from GQ. So those are the two things we're doing. We're doing style, lifestyle, fashion, and then we're doing these, I think, really high-level, you know, written, reported pieces. And so that meant leaving some things out. But it's really this idea of not trying to be everything to everyone. And I took great hope from this idea that, if I went and stopped somebody on the street, a stranger, and said, excuse me, what does GQ mean to you? They'd be like, men's style. And I'm like, great. We can work with that, you know? Whereas I think we're at a time right now where if you're just like, oh, we do a little of this and a little of that, in this incredibly noisy landscape, it's very hard to stand out. So that was the first thing, is like, let's focus on the things that we do, of course, in my biased estimation, better than anyone else on earth. So that was number one. In terms of modernizing, another big piece of it was creatively, in terms of design and photography, just like cleaning things up a little bit and really... I think pushing forward, and then also just embracing this moment where I feel like this is an incredible standout moment for men's fashion. I feel like, and you know, a lot of the editors and so on, and the who are really focused on women's, have they like come up to me and they're like, men's has the juice right now, in terms of just ingenuity, creativity, men. The men who get dressed, so not the designers, but the audience, really trying new things and being open to all kinds of things that were traditionally thought of as off limits to the average man who was just interested in looking good walking out the door. So we've been just really trying to embrace that. So it's been a mix of content focus. The content mix has changed a little bit. The creative direction and design has changed, and then the styling as well.
I noticed, I was looking at the Fashion Week calendar is coming up, and the men's Fashion Week is no longer immediately before the women's. It's got some space. It's kind of in July, along with the other London, Milan, Paris men's Fashion Week. So do you think this will be helpful for men's fashion kind of coming out of the shadow of the women's fashion here in New York?
Well, I think I still think New York Men's Week, it remains to be seen exactly where that's going to land. But I hope in this new role for me at GQ, I can just work with the CFDA and the other powers that be to try to make sure that men's fashion in America and New York Fashion Week is really serving both the designers and then those of us who love it and are interested in it. So I would say it's right now it's not completely resolved, but hopefully we can figure it out. It's been an interesting time for... You know, we're in this strange, unclear transitional period in terms of the way that the fashion show system works globally.
So now with Tom Ford at CFDA,
yes.
Do you feel there's going to be some really positive change happening?
Yeah, well, you know, from my position as the editor of GQ, it's really exciting that the head of the CFDA is somebody who is a menswear designer in addition to womenswear. So that's incredibly exciting. And I know that, you know, Tom is a man of action and firm, decisive opinions.
And perfection.
Yeah, he's got really strong, clear ideas, and he likes to move quickly. And I think all of those things are just fantastic for American fashion in general. And then the fact that it's somebody who has this incredible legacy of menswear is, I just think it's a great thing. It's a great thing.
I could
thing.
See a deep dive coming.
Yeah.
How much do you have to think about advertising with your role as editor-in-chief? Is there kind of a firewall between ad sales and content, or do you have to focus on it?
So there is traditionally a firewall. You know, it's often referred to as, I've heard it called a firewall before, church and state, all these things. But I think the modern way is to be very cognizant of those things. I mean, look, the one reason why the church and state idea, this idea that like the advertising needs to be discussed and figured out on one side of a wall and the editorial on another, is that like I have control over the editorial and I'm going to do what I'm going to do. But the idea that I would turn a blind eye to the business of a magazine that I have been, you know, this great legacy magazine that I've been trusted with, that seems like silly, borderline crazy to me. So I'm very involved with the financial health of the magazine, and incredibly interested in it. I want always more information about what's going on, with our revenue picture, never less. And so I think there was probably this, you know, idea from the past of an editor-in-chief who gets to be sort of like blissfully unaware of what's going on the business side, and maybe nobody is even counting the money that he or she is spending on the editorial side, and money's falling from the sky, and isn't this wonderful church and state. That's just not the modern predicament. And I don't wish it was that way even. I kind of like these strange, rollicking, challenging times in media. I think it suits my personality and it suits my editorial direction for the magazine. And for me, it's fun, you know?
I've been to a bunch of conferences recently, kind of around fashion, around technology. And the ones that I got the least out of were the ones where the main sponsor was also the keynote speaker.
Mm.
That were kind of driven by a publicist who wanted to make it look as good as possible for the advertisers for the next conference.
Right. And that in some way that keynote had perhaps been bought by the sponsorship.
That has to be the assumption, because they were so boring.
Right.
And really did not set the tone for the conference right. In any way.
Yeah. No, I can understand that. I mean,
people seem obsessed with thought leadership and being portrayed as thought leaders.
There is an absolute, you know, it's there's an obsession with being a creative director right now, and there's an obsession with being perceived as a thought leader. And for a lot of these kind of like positions that come with big titles, that is increasingly like an important part of it. Like, got to get you out there as a thought leader. Some people are thought leaders, some are not. It's okay.
And
some people are creative directors, some are not.
There are so many right now being promoted as both of those things that are clearly not. And it's become this farce of so many voices, and it doesn't mean anything anymore, it seems like.
Yeah, and there, you know, and like post TED Talk, there's just been a glut of different summits and so on launched, and some of them are incredibly valid and provocative and interesting and are helping us like share information and figure out our way into the future. And some of them are crass. Some of them are ploys.
I think
incredibly vapid.
Yeah.
I think I heard on the GQ Corporate Lunch, as that was called, podcast, right?
Oh, yeah, so you I listened to a podcast now since you were on our show.
I listened to one or two, and I don't remember his name, unfortunately.
That's okay. Will,
who has now become the creative director.
Or the style editor?
Oh, is he the style editor? I think he was saying he never cared about titles until now.
Oh, Noah Johnson. Yeah, he's the style editor. Yeah, yeah, we don't currently have a creative director. But the fashion director is Mobolaji Dawodu, incredibly talented. He was the fashion director of GQ Style for the last couple of years since we launched that, and is now the fashion director of both. And Noah Johnson was also, he worked at Style.com. Well, going way back, he worked at Complex and then at Style.com. When he and I first sat down to talk about him coming to work at GQ Style, he was doing some freelance for the New York Times, but an incredibly good editor and fashion writer as well. Yeah, and he's one of the hosts on our podcast, Corporate Lunch.
So with people listening to podcasts more than and then reading digital publications, how do you get the word out? You know, if you've lost subscribers, how do you get the word out to people to try the magazine?
Yeah, what we've been doing, I mean, I think this is also part of that, one of the things I was talking about a lot as we were kind of moving into this new era was so GQ has a long, proud tradition of service journalism, especially when it, across everything we do, but especially when it comes to fashion and style. And I was just like, it's incredibly dated. There's still something really urgent and beautiful about a print magazine, but the idea that anyone would come to it to find out the answer to a specific question at this point is ludicrous. They are just going to Google it. So what one of the moves I made was, let's take all the service journalism that I think we were very good at, and let's move all of it. We were already doing it in print and digital. There's a lot of it on digital, but I was like, let's move all of it to digital and allow the print magazine to really thrive as this beautiful thing that you just wanted to hold and savor. So that has always been the glory of print, but magazines did all kinds of different things. In the front of the magazine, there was service journalism. Then as you move to the back, there was feature writing and big, beautiful fashion shoots. And I was like, what if everything in print is bold and beautiful and lush and really considered, and we do all this, like, you know, what the hell is the deal with pleated pants, or, you know, how do you make a cocktail or anything like that? Like, do it all online. How do you wash dark clothes without, you know, all that? We answer all of those questions.
Cold water,
every
turn
day
them inside out.
I'm on GQ.com. Wool light black is how you know, keep your black
flip
jeans
it. I like
fading.
It because then that makes it really exclusive.
Yeah. Yeah, and then that, you know, I talk a lot about, like, let's elevate the environment of GQ across the board, and print is sort of the most glorious shining example of that. And that has been incredibly fun to do, you know, to, like, really focus on. I mean, we ask ourselves before we commit anything to the page, like, would this serve us and our readership just as well online? And if the answer to that is yes, if there's nothing really to be gained by printing it, we just don't print it. Like, there's unlimited bandwidth on GQ.com. There's very limited space in GQ and print. So the only stuff that goes in print is that's where it's really going to shine. And of course, all that stuff also goes on the website.
So I love, and I think it was in the April issue, because everybody is talking about, you know, customers wanting an experience, and part of the experience is really understanding the story.
Yeah.
And you just did, like, a few pages on kind of the art of the craft, craftsmanship.
Yeah.
And it was so beautiful.
Thank you.
But also, I think, really intriguing.
Mm.
You know, do people really understand couture in menswear and what goes into it? It could really start... I think if your intent is to establish a different appreciation.
That's absolutely the intent. Really, and, you know, it was inspired by what we were seeing in the collections. And, like, Claire Wright Keller, for instance, the designer of Givenchy, she launched Couture for Men. And we were like, That is incredibly interesting and some really, really beautiful pieces. I mean, it's amazing what she's doing there. And then we started seeing it, like Kim Jones, who recently took over at Dior, has been using the incredible gifts of the, you know, Dior Atelier to make this like one of a kind, beautiful, beautiful hand crafted clothing for his collections. And so we started seeing more and more of it. And, I did get, there were a couple, I got added on Twitter a couple times, the people who were shocked by the prices in that story, but I'm that like really doesn't bother me at all. I think it's like, it's not about, hey, go buy this $650,000 shirt. It's like, look at this shirt that Dior, that Kim Jones is making for Dior and the craftsmanship that goes into it. It's really a way of, it's almost like a whole new tier of menswear that has always been a part of women's fashion history. And now it's being applied to men. And that to me is like exactly the kind of thing that is exciting about menswear right now. That's just one expression of this new energy going into menswear. And so that is something for us to look at and celebrate and have all that stuff sent to the incredibly creative photographer Arnaud Pivka and kind of let him run wild, send ideas back, and then we kind of workshop them together. And the story that's in the April issue with J. Cole on the cover. Yeah, it's really something that's like, that's different for men's fashion. And those are the things that we're looking for. Does it mean that all of our readers must go buy an obscenely expensive shirt?
No, it just broadens their thinking, I think, when they 100%. Look at other clothing.
I couldn't agree more. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's this idea of like, one thing that men have never had trouble understanding is getting excited about the way things are made. Like back in the late 2000s when menswear was really becoming, in the early phases of becoming a part of the fabric of pop culture, I noticed that was a way a lot of men who were getting excited about fashion for the first time, that's how they were like kind of coming into it. It was almost like looking under the hood of your car or something. I'm obviously trying to use old dated tropes of like masculine interest, but it was like, if you care about the way the car engine works, or if your dad did or granddad, or if that's what men are supposed to care about, like what if you thought about the way a suit is put together in that way? So, yeah, things have come a long way since then. And now it's feather hats and hand sewn shirts and all sorts of beautiful stuff that could very well be in a museum.
Okay. So question on, there was an article in there and I absolutely loved on, Princess Di.
Yes.
So what's your intention there? Like, I'm starting to see in some places collections having men's and women's together.
Yeah.
So are we putting together what's, yeah.
Yeah. Our intention is, well, I guess that page, which we do pretty much every month so far, is called Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. And the idea was to look at non-traditional style icons for us. For like GQ as the staff, our community, our readership, because basically what you get is a lot of like Steve McQueen, men's style icon. And you're like, yeah, okay, we got it. Like, you know, there's five guys, James Dean, Steve McQueen, Miles Davis. Like, okay, yeah, we get it. Those are the men's style icons, but there are all kind of guys that are, there are all kind of people that are style icons to us that are much more interesting than that, or much more surprising, or can't we just broaden the pantheon? Can't we broaden the Hall of Fame? And there's the way that Princess Di dressed, as the writer Rachel Tashjian writes in this piece that is in the issue, is just like totally in step with the times, where she's crashing together types of clothes that shouldn't be crashed together. She's also making little in jokes about being royal. Like there's this bit in there about, you know, this hat she wears that has a crest on it that isn't the, she's just like making jokes, like subversive jokes with the clothing she chose to wear. And that, it was just like, this is a style icon to us now, and it has nothing to do with gender or era or any of that stuff, or like, doesn't she look tough, or, you know, any of these just kind of like dated ideas of what masculinity is supposed to be. So,
I mean, I loved it because she's had definite loud messages coming through there.
Definitely. Yeah. And they just feel
so
like...
And she was so fiercely independent.
Yeah. And there's like clear connection with the way that people are dressing on Mercer Street with the way Princess Di dressed, and like clear connections between like the way Princess Di dressed and what's happening on the Balenciaga runway. You know, it's like all... So yeah, she's an icon for right now. May she rest in peace.
American Fashion Podcast is a bit like a community radio station for the fashion industry. That's what it was intended to be from the start. We do it for you, and we want you involved in the conversation. We all need the fashion industry community to continue the conversation. When we do our interviews each week, this is a beginning. And if it's to do any good, now it has to spread. If you like something someone says here, if some concept resonates with you, let your community and colleagues know. Reach out and share. This is a community thing. We are at AF Pod on Twitter, and on Instagram, we're at American Fashion Show. If you really like an episode, please take a screenshot and tag us so other people can learn about the things we talk about. Not enough people are exposed to these important conversations. We need your help to spread the word. Tell someone or a lot of people about this show, about what we discuss on the show, about ethical practices in our industry. Put a note about something real that we talk about in your newsletter, on your blog, on Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn. If you are a writer, please write reactions to these conversations. And if there is an issue that just burns you up, if we are looking at an issue wrong, please give us a shout. Let's have that discussion. 646-979-8709 is our voicemail line, and info@AmericanFashionPodcast.com is our email address. After this episode ends, we've done what we can, and it's on you to continue the conversation. It's interesting to me that you've become the editor-in-chief after both Jim Nelson and Jim Moore departed the publication. Mm-hmm. So it's like the leaders of the House and Senate and the president are all out of office in Washington, and everything's new.
Yeah.
And you've been there, but you weren't running things. So you've got this very kind of clean slate, a very open field with which to approach the problems that you have.
I'm
guessing that's been very freeing to not have to answer to somebody in that way.
So I started at GQ in 2007 and basically learned everything I know about magazine making from Jim Nelson and everything I know about fashion from Jim Moore, and was, you know, studying at their feet for many years. And at the same time, developing my own ideas and contributing those ideas to for all those years where we were making this magazine together with the two of them at the helm. And then in the beginning of 2016, I got the opportunity to kind of like stay under the very safe roof of GQ, but start this little project called GQ Style as like a quarterly magazine, and began like really in a new way finding or casting forth my voice, just developing my voice, you know. So that was an incredible experience because it was I did feel very safe to take big risks, if that makes sense. And I think we were also able, it was kind of like an unfair start for launching a new magazine, because like, well, hell, it says GQ on the cover, like people are going to pay attention, and they did. And so that was lucky and exciting and all those things. So, that was sort of the process. I like learned from two of the best and then found my own my own way of doing things. And the result is that I just feel confident and well-equipped. And there is a very clean slate in terms of like me and the staff now can do whatever we believe in with the blank pages and the blank ones and zeros on the website and the social media feed, like all bets are off. And I don't, one of the great things about inheriting a title with as strong of a legacy as GQ is I feel like it is solid as a rock. And it's not like I'm going to publish, you know, some story on men's couture, or I'm going to present Princess Di as a GQ fashion icon, and suddenly the foundations of this great magazine are going to come, you know, falling down. Like, the thing is rock solid, and that just really like gives me permission, as I see it, to really run with it. And it's also always been like a progressive, forward-thinking, modern men's magazine. Like, that is what, like, the GQ reader is somebody who likes things that are on the edge. And so I have every intention of honoring that part of the history by like really pushing it, or just really doing the stuff that we believe in. And if that's pushing it, great. And if that's really safe in somebody else's estimation, that's for them to decide. But we do not feel hesitant, or, you know, in fashion speak, it would be like, we must honor the codes of the house, right? Like, we wake up and go to bed honoring the codes of the house. It's not that big of a deal. Like, so whatever our best, boldest ideas are the ones that we're going to do. So, it's, I mean, to be honest, it's very fun.
So that's great. So people that you're working with, that you're surrounded with, are everybody just kind of is free to bring ideas in terms of what they've just seen or who they've just read about, yeah, or who they think is creative.
Yep, absolutely.
That, it's like, how far will you go in creative minds that you showcase?
We will go as far, any place that we get excited about, we'll go there. And that is an incredibly exciting, you know, as the leader of a team, that is incredibly exciting and incredibly fulfilling to be able to just kind of like honor the best ideas that come out of like the conversations that we have, and to empower people to say, like, if you've got something great, like that fits in with this, with the spirit of what we're doing here, then we can do it, you know? And, you mentioned Noah Johnson, who's one of the hosts of, he's the style editor at GQ and GQ Style and hosts Corporate Lunch. So he worked with me on the very small GQ Style team for a few years. And Noah grew up in Troy, New York, and is a skateboarder. And so he, from the beginning, was bringing ideas from the world of skateboarding and streetwear and skate clothing and the way that skate has increasingly become a loud part of fashion and the influence. And so that became part of like what we do pretty much issue to issue in that magazine. And that's just because that's Noah, that's who Noah is, and those are his personal interests. Now we're with a much bigger team making both GQ and GQ Style. Like, GQ Style was just four of us. And so it can be a little bit more competitive as far as everybody's personal interests getting a feature every issue. But the opportunity is there, and that it just makes you feel good as a leader to really be able to draw that out of people and really make space for it. And I think part of it too is just like that idea of not self-imposing limitations.
Yeah, so people aren't afraid to come forward with something.
Or, like, yeah, and they don't see me tearing my hair out like, mm-hmm, is this GQ? Like, no, GQ's whatever we make it, and that changes day to day and month to month. And and I also find our audience has been very willing to go with us in this new direction. I anticipated way more, like, you know, people who just like went to the website every day or follow us on social media or can't wait to get the new issue in the mailbox, that they had been like sort of trained to expect something, and that there would be a little bit more squawking and gnashing of teeth when all of a sudden those things changed. But really, I have found our audience just incredibly willing to like.
You brought them a richer palette of cooler stuff.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, but one has to assume that not everyone is going to see it that way.
Yeah.
And, you know, I get some hate mail. Thank God. A little bit of hate mail. You know, you want a little bit. You're not doing it right if you don't get a little of that.
Yeah. I think people are innately curious, mm-hmm. want to know new things, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you talked about, I don't know, top 15 hotels in the world.
Yeah.
And mentioned, like, a composer that I don't think very many people know about.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, so Nico
Muley.
Nico Muley, yeah. Yeah. And that's so great, like, yeah. to open up.
It was like, who are people that are incredibly interesting? So we were doing this thing about hotels worth returning to again and again, and those places where you just, like, you stay once maybe and they're amazing and you can't wait to go back, and then you begin to develop a bit of a relationship with the place, and, you know, maybe the maitre d' remembers your name and the restaurant, or that you have a favorite room to stay in, or whatever the case may be. And that, like, pleasure of returning to places, it was something that we wanted to do a piece about. And so, yeah, there were like 15 hotels or so. And we were like, oh, let's ask for some picks for some people with great taste who are incredibly well-traveled. Let's find out what they think. And one of them was Nico Muley, who's a composer who was trained at Columbia and Juilliard, he's my age.
Operas.
Yeah, he's had two operas at the Met. Incredibly successful composer. As it goes with young composers, he's not hugely famous, but he is incredibly sophisticated, incredibly accomplished. And let's see. He chose a hotel. Was it in the Faroe Islands?
I think it was in Iceland.
Maybe it was in Iceland, yeah. And of course, you know, he chose a place that nobody on staff would have picked, and that's exactly what's exciting. And the other thing that's going on there is a little bit of a, like, we're playing games with expectations a little bit. So, like, you know, for a magazine like ours, which is about fashion and style and lifestyle, to do a package about great hotels is pretty much, that's like relatively familiar territory. But then it's like, how can we mess with it a little bit? Is definitely part of the intention there. And
get in trouble with your other magazines, travel magazines.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. How can we do it our way? So they say, okay. But that is something we ask. Like, when an idea comes up, I'll be like, could Condé Nast Traveler do this better? Or if a food idea comes up, like, is there any reason for this to be in GQ specifically and not in Bon Appetit, which is like our sister food magazine that is amazing? And if we can't answer that question, why is this in GQ, then we probably won't do the story.
And do you ever, I mean, as you mentioned that, do you ever all kind of get together and exchange current thinking?
Not in any formalized way. There has been increasing communication and the meetings with everybody in it. Like, Condé Nast is a very different environment than it was the way when I started there in 2007. There's much more sharing of information. All that is much easier, but most of it happens more organically. So, I mean, to use the Bon Appetit example, Adam Rappaport, who's the editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit, he was the style editor at GQ before I had that title. So he and I were, he actually is the one who called me and said, hey, there's an opening at GQ. So now he's the editor of Bon Appetit. So if you've been, you know, if you've been around the company for a long time, like I have, you get to know people, and then there's more organic conversation, which is nice.
Yeah, that's
great. So you're doing your own podcast now, Corporate Lunch, is that
Corporate
right?
Corporate Lunch, that's right.
What's it about?
It is like pretty like deep into the mind garden of those of us who do it. It's almost weekly. I've been doing it a little bit less recently. Originally, it was me and Noah Johnson talking about style and getting dressed in the morning. And I mean, we both like talk about fashion, like talk about stuff that's happening at the fashion houses on the runway, but also talk about just what it's like to be a person who lives in New York City and works at a fashion magazine and cares about the way they dress. And so we talk about like the designers we wear and a new pair of shoes that came out. And Noah has a habit of trying to find the perfect t-shirt from Japanese proxy services and like what that whole process is like, you know what I mean? So it's like, it's not advanced in the sense of like, we're like trained, in fashion or anything like that, but it's just pretty, like I said, like pretty lost in the mind garden about men's style, basically. And then since I started this role at the beginning of the year, I've been on it less, and Rachel Tashian, who wrote the Princess Di piece, among a lot of other great stuff since she arrived at GQ. Rachel's one of those people who had a big impact on the GQ voice the day she arrived. Great fashion writer. And then a young editor named Sam Hine. And so I've been doing it less. They've been carrying the torch forward. But it's pretty fun. We joke that it's relatable content because, like, sometimes somebody's stressing about, like, the way their socks interact with their shoes or, you know what I mean, just some really regular workaday stuff or how to wash. I don't know.
Oh, that's where the information is.
I'm lost for examples. Yeah, but it's
how to wash your colored clothes.
It's like people who care a lot about style just, like, being incredibly open about that process. So, like, it's not very professional. It's very just, like, honest and fun, I think. And, we started calling it relatable content because people started telling us, that's, like, really relatable stuff. Like, you know, I wonder the same things. So.
Zip, then fasten, or fasten, then zip?
What's that?
Zip, then fasten, or fasten, then zip?
That is always the question.
That is the question.
You hear guys who are really obsessed with sneakers talking about how they pick their sneakers and then they get dressed around that. And I'm like, the shoes are always the last thing whatever. It's just fun. It's like very conversational.
Right, which is why you can't dictate, right? Because everybody starts someplace else.
That's right. Like that has been a bit of a mantra as well. It's like this idea that GQ or anybody else is like the beacon of shining authority on the mountaintop that is going to dictate what you can and cannot wear and the way your suit must be and what shirt goes with what tie. I just think it's not the era for that. Like, nobody cares. You can dictate issue authority all you want, and people are going to are just like having fun getting dressed and like being excited about fashion and talking about. We were joking that so in the current issue of GQ Style, there's a portfolio where we had the just incredible photographer Pari Dukovic go to, Virgil Abloh's debut at Louis Vuitton, Kim Jones's debut at Dior, and Eddie Slimane's debut at Celine, all in one season. So like this incredible moment of change and upheaval and paradigm shift in men's fashion. And I think the most like, there was more broad cultural interest in that Paris Fashion Week than there has ever been in menswear in one given moment. And we were like, we should be there and we should document it. And that's kind of what, that's like the GQ Style way. But there's this funny idea that it was almost like on an episode of Corporate Lunch or in the GQ office on a given day, we talk about what's going on at the fashion houses and what's happening with the designer merry-go-round and all that, almost the way, you know, others probably talk about like professional sports or like coaches changing between, NFL teams or whatever the case may be. And that just is new and it's exciting for us.
So any surprises? You said you had some emails that weren't nice. I can't imagine that there were many, but any emails?
Some comments on Instagram.
Yeah, comments that have come through to you that you're like, wow, it's really resonating or.
So like somebody who offered some like constructive criticism or something that I really took to heart.
I don't know, something that was, that made you feel like you were headed in the right place.
Oh, yeah. So. One thing that has been incredibly important to me is just this idea of community. So I have always thought of magazine not as a megaphone or a one-way opportunity to like proselytize and more. This kind of goes back to my beginnings at an independent music magazine in New York called The Fader. And it was more about like this community of people and a point of view, which is what any magazine offers. And so I thought it was incredibly important to sort of identify a community of creative peers who work in fashion and photography. And I mean, it's everybody, it's DJs and writers and designers and just people who speak our language and who we think their vision of the world is compelling to those of us at GQ, and that there's some share between our point of view and theirs. And that one thing that GQ could offer was like, rather than again being a megaphone, if it instead was sort of like a campfire where people, where somewhat like-minded people, although they might disagree and challenge each other, kind of gather around that campfire. So that's what we've been trying to create. And the most important, the stuff that has meant the most to me over the last few months, because we're really just getting started doing that, is when a musician's creative director. So a lot of celebrities have their own in-house creative director these days. He like DM'd me on Instagram yesterday and he was like, I just wanted to thank you for making GQ like, you know, like the center of what's happening in our culture right now. And it means a lot to us that like this, you know, mainstream voice with a great history is like really in step with what's going on in our world. And that just meant like the world to me, because not only because it's nice, but because that is exactly what we had set out to do. So it just makes you feel like, okay, it's working. We're making progress. Another big moment for us was last week we released the May cover story, which is Keanu Reeves. And I expected our audience to love it. And I thought we had an incredibly strong shoot. I'm very proud. It's a black and white cover. And people say, oh, you're just not going to get the engagement with a black and white photograph that you get with color. And I'm just like, hold on a second.
Watch this.
Yeah. And it was just like this incredible cultural moment over not just Keanu Reeves, who very rarely participates in photo shoots and interviews like this, but the way that we presented him. And there were like really cool conversations to follow on social media about black and white, about the nature of the styling. And then of course, people making memes out of the pictures and picking apart every aspect of the interview and all that stuff that makes like doing compelling storytelling in the digital social media era really fun. Cause you just like, it's almost like a little paper boat that you make and you go to the edge of the lake and you shove it out. And then like, you just watch what happens to it. It is no longer in your control. Like it's not in GQ's control. It's not in Keanu Reeves' control. It's just like people just take it and run with it. And that stuff is incredibly exciting, but yeah, long live black and white photography.
Absolutely. So you keep referencing music and your editor's letter in your first issue as editor-in-chief was about music, and the cover says this is the music issue, and you've got all these musicians on the cover again and again. You talk in that editor's letter about music driving style and music driving fashion. Can you be more specific about that? Where have we seen this? Where has it really driven?
Absolutely. So part of that is almost like a declaration of my subject position, like as the very subjective editor-in-chief of this new magazine. I'm just going to go ahead and be honest with you that like for me, like every encounter that I had growing up with style or that I have now, it kind of starts with music. And so another thing to note is the February issue was kind of committed as a music issue before I became editor-in-chief.
Well, that was lucky.
I know. I was like, I could have changed it. I didn't have to do it, but I was like, I'm just going to let that remain the case because I feel like that plays to my strengths, and it was a little bit of a way for me to make my first issue in a comfort zone.
That's a thing that magazines do so that advertisers can know this is the issue I should advertise in.
It could be for all kinds of reasons. I think especially when you're a magazine that does a lot of different things, it can be something that readers really love, of knowing that, like, okay, at this, in the spring, we're going to get this issue. Like, GQ in the past has done a comedy issue that was incredibly beloved, and music issues. And I think it's important not to make every month have some theme, but occasionally to do a theme. It just breaks up that idea of, like, you know, another, it's the April issue. It's like, well,
even Taco Tuesdays gets monotonous.
Yeah, that's right. You know? So yeah, but for me, like, growing up, at first I was into, when I was a young kid through my dad, I was into country music growing up in Atlanta, Georgia. And then I discovered pop music and was really into, a lot of the great, the like pop music at the time. I remember listening to like Boyz II Men and Paula Abdul and things like that. Michael Jackson, of course. And then in junior high school, I discovered, through a friend of mine, the Grateful Dead. My best friend, he was a bass player. I was a drummer, a very bad drummer, but I played the drums. His father was like a major Deadhead. And that was my exposure to so much music in their music room. All of his dad's vinyl was there. And so you're just like picking up this like really cool dad's record collection and digging through it. And I remember seeing the Joe Jackson cover with the like white, are they're not quite creepers, but they have like a pointed toe and a buckle on them like that. And, you know, he's got drainpipe trousers that show like just the right amount of sock and all that kind of stuff. And you're just, or looking at like, old Allman Brothers records, and they've all got long hair and these big mutton chop sideburns, and they're naked together in a river outside of Macon, Georgia, you know? And like that picture is like a fashion picture to me. Or in retrospect, I received it as such. And then, you know, I discovered, jazz on my own. You know, I received the Grateful Dead through my cool friend's cool dad. And then on my own, through playing a lot of basketball as a kid, I discovered Outkast, which was this great group coming out of my hometown. And I remember this moment where, and one of the songs on the second Outkast album, where Andre 3000's talking about this really specific bus, MARTA, which is the, you know, MTA. He's talking about this one bus line. And I'm like, I know that bus line. And that like meant so much to me, you know, and what Outkast did with Clothes, kind of coming out of the, a lot of it to me is sort of seemed like an homage to Parliament Funkadelic. Does that make sense? So basically as a kid and as a teen and into my 20s, I'm following musical threads and learning about style, David Bowie, all the, you know, as you're listening through all of David Bowie's albums and discovering these musical transitions, there are all these fashion style, personal style transitions that happen with all the musical shifts. And so I'm just a music lover. I was a music lover first before I was exposed in a real way to fashion with a capital F. And through music, I began to explore style. And then through both of those things, I like came to learn more about fashion. So it's really just kind of my point of view. I hope that by the time, you know, by the end of 2019, we'll have a nice mix of, there'll be a couple musicians on the cover, some actors, maybe some surprises in there that nobody sees coming, where we're messing with the format a little bit.
It's me. I'm going to be on the cover.
Yeah, that's right. Charles on the October cover. But yeah, that, you know, so it was basically like, oh, February is like loosely slated to be a music issue. Why don't I leave that be? Because like that is that's like home field advantage or something, you know?
Yeah, definitely. They're all cultural communication, music, the lyrics, style, how people present themselves, magazines. It's all communication of culture from, you know, people who have a perspective,
yeah,
and sharing it.
I mean, I've actually never quite had this thought, but I really love photography and think I bring a strong visual direction to the magazine. And my first exposure to photography was all through album covers and shoots of musicians, you know, like it. I have friends who, like, his parents had Helmut Newton books and stuff like that, but that was not the house or really the community that I grew up in. So for me, it was like I was buying all these jazz records and then buying posters of the of the musicians that I saw. So, you know, it was like Miles Davis, Charlie Parker, Brooks Brothers suits, black and white photography in the jazz clubs downtown. So, I mean, music was my first, where I discovered fashion. It was where I discovered photography. I guess even design, like a lot of those jazz record covers of such beautiful and different record labels, they would be one designer who would be there for 30 years and they had like such a clear voice. You know, a Blue Note record looks like a Blue Note record. An Impulse record looks like an Impulse record. Later I discovered ECM, which is this like incredibly ethereal, all the creative direction for no matter what kind of music you find it. You know, some wild noise music, but it has this incredibly ethereal, almost like featherlight graphic design touch to it. So I guess it's just music was my entree into those things.
Will, thank you so much for coming.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure.
Thank you. This was great.
Good. Thank you guys so much. And thanks for reading.
Thank you for listening to American Fashion Podcast, a weekly look under the hood of the fashion business. And yes, the oil is leaking, and yes, it's possible we have no brakes. To get on the guest list for our live events, go to AmericanFashionPodcast.com and look for the live shows link. Please continue the conversation from the show on social media. On Twitter, we're at AFPOD, and on Instagram, we're at American Fashion Show. And I personally am at Fashion Tech Guru on just about everything. I meet people all the time who are so excited to hear about this show. A lot of people have heard about it, but not everybody, not enough people know this show exists. And we need your help to spread the word. Please do so. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, there's a Be a Guest form on the AmericanFashionPodcast.com website. But it helps if you've already started a discussion with us through social media. For direct comments, our voicemail line is 646-979-8709. Or email us info@AmericanFashionPodcast.com. American Fashion Podcast is produced by Mouth Media Network, which holds the copyright to this and other episodes of the series, all rights reserved. Subsist, friends. Keep making things beautiful. Remain in force. I'm Charles Beckwith, and we'll talk to you again next week.